TexasObserver.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. This week, we've got Observer editor Dave Mann in the studio. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you.
Also with us is Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels, who will be sharing his story, Fight for Right, about an East Texas family's search for justice after one of their own died mysteriously. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi, thanks.
You guys, we sort of failed to mention on the last episode, but we've recorded 50 episodes of Observer Radio now.
Woohoo!
Whoa, party
admittedly,
time.
Not much of a milestone for a weekly radio show, but I'll take it.
The 50th is the microphone anniversary.
Yeah, so we all get mics.
Yeah, it works.
But I'd like to give a big thanks out to Co-op here in Austin for helping us produce the show, and also to all of you out there supporting the show and listening to us every week. Thank you so much. Later in the show, we'll be joined by University of Texas Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs Dean Robert Hutchings to discuss the upcoming Civil Rights Summit, marking the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act at the LBJ Library here in Austin. But first, we have some news to discuss, and I think we should start with the battle over equal pay. In one corner, we have Greg Abbott, and in the other, we have Wendy Davis. Dave, can you give us a little background on the battle and explain what it means for Davis's campaign moving forward?
Sure, yeah. The governor's race is heating up again, and the dynamics have changed a little bit. Wendy Davis's campaign, I think it's safe to say, has had a really good couple of weeks. And Greg Abbott has definitely been on the defensive, kind of starting with the Ted Nugent controversy.
Right.
And has kind of followed through to this debate over equal pay. And the basics on this are that it kind of all stems from what's called the Lilly Ledbetter Act. And that's a piece of federal legislation. But there's also a state law or a state bill here in Texas that was going to be a state version of the federal law. And it passed the legislature last year in 2013. And Wendy Davis was the Senate sponsor of that legislation. And it was vetoed by Rick Perry. And what the bill was going to do is basically make it easier for women to file pay discrimination lawsuits against their employers if they feel like their pay was being, you know, a result of discrimination. And of course, we all know that, you know, women get paid on average much less than men. What is 70 cents on the dollar, 77 cents.
Right.
So, you know, this was a bill designed to address that. And right now, the law says that, you know, if you got 6 months after, you know, your salary is set to file a suit, and this would say, well, you know, you've got 6 months after you discover that you're being discriminated against to file a suit. So it really would, you know, has a chance to lengthen the window through which women, if they're being discriminated against in the workplace, could kind of take that action to court. And kind of a way to address, you know, sexism and discrimination in the workplace in Texas. But that didn't happen. Perry vetoed it. And Wendy Davis has been trying to make an issue of it in the governor's race, and she got a big assist from Greg Abbott.
Right.
Because he was asked. I mean, Wendy Davis make an issue of it, and then Abbott gets the predictable question, you know, what would you do on Lilly Ledbetter if you were governor? And he kind of didn't answer it. I mean, he just kind of sidestepped it for kind of a long time. And then finally came out and said, actually, you know, I'm against that. And I would have vetoed it, and I will veto it just like Rick Perry did. And while I am against pay discrimination and I'm a supporter of Texas women, I would not have signed this bill. And of course, Wendy Davis's campaign took that and ran with it and got a boost from a news story in the San Antonio Express News that discovered that Greg Abbott's attorney general's office pays on average more money to men than to women. So that kind of exploded this issue. And of course, it played into the hands of the Wendy Davis campaign, which is trying to kind of energize women in Texas and get people energized to vote and bring out a new kind of, a new kind of a voter, a new electorate. So
it seems like it's energized her in a way that she hasn't been for a while as well.
Yeah, I think it's all playing together. I think the Ted Nugent thing, and I think this debate has really given her campaign not only a sense of momentum, but kind of a sense of purpose. I mean, they kind of seemed aimless for a while, and they were making mistakes, and they couldn't recover, and mostly they seemed on the defensive. And ever since Ted Nugent, you know, Greg Abbott has been doing things that just make you scratch your head. And Wendy Davis has certainly been on the offense and controlling the narrative, controlling the debate. With the fair pay debate, it's been a real turn for Wendy Davis. And, you know, it's still early. Who knows how long this, I'm sure it'll turn again. But for the moment, I mean, Wendy Davis's campaign is on a roll. And Greg Abbott, I mean, what is he doing?
And it extends down to, you know, some Republican women who've stepped up to sort of take his side in things and have said some kind of head-scratching things as well. And, you know, Chris Hooks rounded them up on our website a couple of weeks ago. But there was the Texas Republican Party executive director who basically said that the problem was that women should be better negotiators like men are. And then there was the someone from Red State Women PAC, which is this new, you know, Republican Women PAC, that just basically said that women are too busy to mess with the court system to get better pay. And so all these kind of defenses are kind of falling flat. I mean, I think the bigger thing probably the reason behind Rick Perry's veto of it is business concerns about getting saddled with more lawsuits and sort of, you know, the Republican tort reform tradition that we've had for years and years. But instead, it's you know, instead of becoming about the courts and lawsuits, it's become a very personal thing for Greg Abbott.
Yeah, and you wonder why he decided to pick a fight on this issue. I mean, I have no doubt he believes it, but I mean, it'd be very easy and better politics either to sidestep it or just to say, well, that's a hypothetical. I don't know what I would do. I'd have to see the specific. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to diffuse this versus coming out and saying, no, I'm against that. And I think by doing that, yeah, he really poured fuel on the fire. And again, with the yeah, the ridiculous comments by these Republican women who are coming. I mean, the Red State Women thing was designed to help Republicans seem more appealing to women voters. And this the head of it comes out and says, yeah, women are just too busy to be, you know, negotiating for fair pay. They're too busy to be getting more money. I mean, it's just like, where is that? I mean, one, where do they find this person? Why is she going out without talking points? Why is she saying this? I mean, from a political standpoint, it's bizarre.
And it also, I mean, it lets Wendy Davis stay on the offensive and paint the Greg Abbott and the Republicans as anti-woman without really having the abortion conversation and talk about reproductive health, and, you know, which is kind of the thing that still hasn't gotten out there so much in the campaign that we're kind of waiting on. That, you know, this is a lot safer for her to get out there on.
Yeah, this is like this is the territory for her to be on. I mean, if you look at the big picture, I mean, she starts 10 points down. You know, that's the natural breakdown in Texas is Republicans have a 10-point advantage at the starting line. And so that's the reason everyone says, well, she doesn't have that great a chance to win. But her chance comes when the Republican, Greg Abbott, in this case, runs a terrible campaign. And if they leave an opening for Wendy Davis, she certainly can win. And this is exactly the kind of narrative, if you wanted to paint a scenario and a narrative that would allow Wendy Davis to kind of come from behind and win this race, this is the kind of thing you would envision happening, is kind of Greg Abbott kind of having these issues, having these problems with his campaign, kind of debating on the wrong topics, being on the defensive, making mistakes. And the more that happens, the more you see the territory to Wendy Davis. And, you know, if this keeps going on and on, you could certainly foresee a scenario where Wendy Davis would win.
Real quickly, though, Wendy Davis was catching some flack recently. Patrick, can you speak to that?
Well, this is, I mean, the Abbott campaign has sort of, you know, their emails out to the press. They'll say, you know, here's our rebuttal to the equal pay thing. And then also, hey, why don't you spend more time talking about Wendy Davis's clients from her law firm and the bond advising she's done for public entities that are trying to get bonds, you know, and Wendy Davis is contributing to the public debt crisis has been sort of the narrative they're trying to put out there. You know, and she's basically been in her private practice been advising like the DFW airport and some local municipalities around North Texas on their bond proposals. And so, I mean, relative to the equal pay thing, it's really kind of fallen flat so far. I mean, what she's done, this is another big question though going into the campaign, is who has she been working for in her private practice that she hasn't made public yet? And she made public her clients' in the public sector. But I don't believe that her private sector clients or her law partners' clients have been made public yet.
Yeah, I thought that was a really smart move because she came out and handed, you know, everybody, handed the press the list of clients. And that kind of moved to diffuse a scandal, I think, or at least a controversy.
And if the worst you're going to get is you were advising these folks on their bond bond issues.
I mean, yeah, that's not exactly the hot headline issue. But, I mean, it's a legitimate campaign topic for sure. I mean, who she's working for and who she's making money from. But because she came out and I think partially diffused it by releasing the list of clients herself, and that's out there. Now, when the Greg Abbott campaign is trying to change the subject from being on the defensive about fair pay to Wendy Davis's clients, I think the reaction in the press is, well, that's kind of an old story. I mean, we wrote that a couple of weeks ago. We've been there. We've seen that. We haven't seen her partner's clients. I mean, it hasn't caught on. And I think that's partially, because Greg Abbott's on the defensive so much, and it's kind of hard to turn it around. But two, because Wendy Davis partially diffused it by releasing the list of clients herself.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Patrick Michaels has been following the mysterious case of Alfred Wright's death in East Texas for quite some time. Now he's got a comprehensive look at this story, which you can check out in the April edition of the Texas Observer. Patrick, for those at home who have not been following Alfred Wright's story as closely as you have, can you give us a sense of this story?
Sure. I mean, the story goes back to last November. It was early in the month when Alfred Wright, his 28-year-old black man from Jasper, which is in East Texas, he disappeared kind of one night. He called his wife, said he was having car trouble, and asked for a ride home. His folks got up there to pick him up, and then he was gone. And so they're wondering where he was. And there was a large search of the area. It was a rural bit in the county, a little bit north of Jasper. The local sheriff, the mayor of Jasper went out in his airplane. There was a whole bunch of volunteers from the town. They all went looking for him and couldn't find him anywhere. And there were a lot of theories about what was going on. But the search was called off after 4 days after he went missing. So that's the point at which I heard about the story. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, there are a lot of folks saying, well, 4 days isn't very long to be searching before calling it off. And there was some concern that, so a black man in East Texas, they're only going to search for 4 days. And if it had been like a young white mother of two, how much longer would they have gone searching? Think about these cable news stories about, somebody who goes missing on a cruise boat that are, go on and on for months, and captivate the country. And so people saw some disparity there. I was out there. I happened to be out there at the time. And on the evening news in Beaumont, it was sort of a big story, but nobody really knew what happened to him. And it took 18 days after he disappeared. His family went out looking in the same area where he was had last been seen, and they ended up finding his body. And it was in an area where the law enforcement had searched or said that they had looked around, but they this particular area, they had told people not to go out there on the search party looking. So the family was very suspicious of all this. And so now there's a Texas Rangers investigation going on. They're being overseen by the Department of Justice in some capacity. But there's no word on the investigation yet. It's not closed. So in the meantime, the family has been trying to get answers, and they're being told that the cops can't say anything. They've enlisted a whole bunch of activists as well who have been holding rallies and really trying to keep the attention on this case. The family is pretty convinced that Alfred Wright was murdered, and they say that it's a police cover up. And the police, like I said, they're just staying out of it. They say they can't say anything. So in the meantime, there have been a lot of theories out there thrown around, and so many strange circumstances around his death. The other thing that needs to be mentioned in the introduction here is you say the name Jasper, and that'll mean something to a lot of people right away. That's the town where in 1998. A black man named James Byrd Jr. Was dragged behind a truck by three white men, and this brutal murder, sort of one of the most famous race killings you know, in U.S. history.
Right.
And this town is always kind of, I mean, from that point on, has been trying to, you know, a lot of people have been trying to live down the legacy of that. Folks in the white community say, well, it's, you know, this is an isolated thing with a few folks. This isn't about the town. But, you know, it still has that sort of name recognition in the national press, too.
And there have been other incidents since then, right? In the last 3 or 4 years, there have been other incidents in Jasper that were at the very least kind of dredging up, you know, this kind of racist history that they have, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was just in the last few years, it's a really sort of like sloppily handled thing where the city council, which had been majority black at that point, hired a man named Rodney Pearson, would have been the first black police chief in the city's history, which is, you know, after the, you know, in the legacy of the bird killing is a major accomplishment for the black community. And you know, some community leaders who are white said, well, he isn't qualified to be police chief, and he was hired over some more qualified candidates. And so, you know, rather than, I don't know, I mean, they were really active about it, and they held a recall election. They got petitions. They held a recall election for 3 of the black city council members and got 2 of them taken out of office. They were replaced by white members who right away got rid of that police chief and hired a white police chief instead. So that was one notable incident. And the other one recently was a black woman who was beaten pretty savagely in the Jasper police headquarters by 2 white cops. I was caught on video with that. And so again, when the cops were fired and the new police chief says, hey, this is an isolated incident, you can't read too much into it.
How many isolated incidents do you get? That's the question.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and that's what I found so interesting about this piece is that Alfred Wright's father has experienced a lot of this firsthand in his youth and growing up and living in the area. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's sort of what ties those questions about Jasper to the Wright story, because the circumstances of his death are so strange. You know, and the autopsy report on him. You know, the toxicology report says that he had really high levels of drugs. They attribute his death to a drug overdose. So to say that it was murder at this point is really sort of stretching what we know, right? But outside of that, I mean, the reason that his case has become such a civil rights cause locally is because of this history in Jasper, and because of his family and who they are. And his father, Douglas Wright, was actually born and raised in Mississippi. During the civil rights movement in the middle of the 60s. And his dad was a Methodist pastor at a church that had been burned by the Klan. And if you've seen the movie Mississippi Burning, it's that church that is like shown on fire at the start of the movie, where some civil rights workers who came down to that church after it was burned were murdered by Klansmen as well. And it triggered a whole FBI investigation. It was a really bloody summer. And sort of just the nastiest, worst small town aspects of the civil rights movement were right where Douglas Wright was growing up, and he was the boy to integrate his school in 8th grade. He was the first black student in his school, so he'd really, you know, lived through the thick of the civil rights movement and you know, been an active part of that. So he moved to Jasper as an adult. And was sort of a community leader there, and led he spoke at a student walkout at the school when a black coach had been fired. So he was really in the thick of that, and he's a Methodist pastor in town as well. So as soon as this happened, he said he knew exactly what was going on. He saw another civil rights battle happening right now.
Yeah, and there were these incredible parallels, right? I mean, he's seen these police cover-ups before, and the Mississippi Burning, you know, incident that you're referring to, he kind of recounts in your story that they didn't really learn some of the truth in that case until they sent one of the bodies, you know, away for an independent autopsy, because the information that was coming out of the local cops was basically lies. And they didn't really learn the truth until they got this independent autopsy. And so when his own son dies, that's one of the things he wants to do, is he doesn't trust the law enforcement. He doesn't trust the authorities to do the autopsy. He doesn't trust what they're saying. He wants his own, he wants to hire his own, you know, autopsy done, right? And so I think there's these interesting parallels in your story, you know, from his history and his family's history and everything in this area. You know, you begin to understand why, you know, he believes that there's this, you know, police cover up going on.
And you talk to folks in the town is Hemp Hill, where Alfred Wright disappeared, and that's in Sabine County, a little bit north of Jasper. I talk to folks in that town there, which is mostly white. And it's really similar to some of the things that people were saying after James Byrd's killing in the 90s. And they're saying, well, I mean, you really see how what different places people are coming from. And say for Douglas Wright, I mean, he has this formative thing, this horrible series of murders, you know, that he was right there for in his childhood. And so that's kind of the lens that he's seeing all this through. And for some of the white folks in Hemp Hill who, you know, just don't see any problems and you know, if it doesn't make the newspaper, you know, some sort of racist antagonism isn't going to be something they notice necessarily. They're going to say, we don't have any problems. And it's a pretty typical response. If you're not living it, then you're not going to see the whole experience.
And there was this weird thing when they were searching for the body. I mean, there before the autopsy report came out, there was this moment when it really did look like a cover-up, because the police did their search and they never found the body, but they refused to search, as you said, this one little area that was very near where he disappeared. And the family kept asking them to search it, and everyone's like, you got to search this area, and they just refused. And lo and behold, after the official search was over and the family did their own search, that's where they found his body. And it just seems so suspicious and bizarre that the one area that seemed logical to search, and they absolutely refused to for unknown reasons or questionable reasons, that's where the body was found, in a very strange state, right? So before the autopsy came out and before we knew that there were drugs in his system, there was this time when it seemed very, very plausible, at the least, that this was some kind of, you know, the police were involved or some kind of cover-up. Right. So there was this moment where that seems so likely, even.
And that's one thing the sheriff would talk about at the time. But it was also, you know, different people heard different stories about why they couldn't search there. And there were things like people showed up to search from Jasper, you know, mostly black family members and you know, friends and community leaders. And they were told, well, you're not wearing the right shoes, or you're not wearing the right clothes to go out there and into these woods, or, you know, you don't look like you're in good enough shape. That's what folks told me they heard from the sheriff and from folks leading the search. And the sheriff says, well, it was private property and we didn't have permission yet to go out there, and it wasn't safe necessarily. You know, it was hunting season. We couldn't have people going out there on their own. But they led a really, you know, expansive search that was pretty well organized from the way people describe it and what I've seen. But there was this area that was really close to where a lot of his belongings had been found, that was just kind of in a different direction. That was never officially searched, and it took the family and some volunteers doing that a few weeks later to find him.
Well, the story is Fight for Right. You can read that on TexasObserver.org. Patrick, thanks for sharing this story with us.
Yeah, thanks.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. And joining us now via phone is University of Texas Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs Dean Robert Hutchings. The school is hosting a civil rights summit at the LBJ Presidential Library here in Austin to mark the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. Dean Hutchings, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the air.
So I don't think we can really overemphasize what a big event this summit is going to be. My first question is, what does it take to put together a summit like this? I imagine one of the greatest challenges is coordinating with not one, but four presidents.
Well, I should first give a nod to my colleagues at the LBJ Foundation and the LBJ Presidential Library, who have been instrumental in securing the acceptances of four presidents, which was not easy. So we've been at this for quite a while because, you know, we were anticipating for quite a while now that we wanted to mount a major summit here at the school and library in Austin to mark the 50th anniversary. So we've had invitations outstanding for some time. And of course, with people like this, you have to work various angles and have various people contact them, get this on the schedule. And it came together just beautifully because this really is historic. And I would say a unique event in which four presidents, one current president, three former presidents, are not only in the same place at the same time, but actually have substantive speaking roles at the same event.
So I was interested in looking at the programming. I mean, much of the weekend is going to be about celebrating the legacy of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. But there's also going to be a fair focus, it looks like, from speakers on sort of the next civil rights challenges that we're facing.
Exactly. And this is, of course, a special interest of us here in the school because we are a public policy school, and it's good and appropriate to look back 50 years to appraise the monumental legislative record of President Johnson and what it's done to transform the country. But we also want to use this as a springboard for a conversation about what this means for 2014 and the years ahead. How do we think about some of the unfinished business from 50 years ago, and how do those issues play out today? Some of them are familiar issues, the same issues that we were seized with back then. Others are new issues, or they've developed in new ways. So it's a really huge opportunity, and I would say also an opportunity to look back at a time when we had a government that got things done. The passage of so much legislation contrasts with the what we too often see as gridlock in Washington, and our appeal here is to use the summit as a way of catalyzing a new public debate about the need for more young women and men of talent to go into public service, to change the world and make it better, not simply to regret that there's not more getting done, but to go in there and be change agents.
Would you say that that's why you've chosen to highlight some up-and-coming prominent politicians at the summit, including Julian Castro?
Exactly. So we have, appropriately, veterans of the civil rights struggles of many years ago, including Julian Bond and John Lewis and Andrew Young and many, many others, but also have younger politicians who represent the challenges that are facing the state and the country today.
I wanted to ask what your thoughts are on why there's such a difference today when you compare it to, you know, what it was like when LBJ was president, and you talk about getting things done, and gridlock seems to be discussed so much and so rampant. Do you think that it's a leadership issue? And obviously LBJ is renowned for, his ability to kind of get legislation passed and bend the political process to his will. Do you think it's a leadership issue, or do you think it's more an issue of kind of the politics of our time leading to gridlock and leading to the inability, not just getting things done, but as you said, you know, the lack of kind of reform or change going through the political process?
I'm too much of an optimist to believe this is just sort of a permanent feature, that we can never recover the time when we were able to get things done. There were periods of governmental gridlock before LBJ, and there will be periods of gridlock in the distant future as well. But a lot of this is in our hands. I think the kind of hyper-partisanship and gridlock we see, especially at the federal level in politics today, doesn't need to be made permanent. And that's why I'm a dean of a public policy school, I think, because I want to send more young women and men out there to be change agents. I tell them I had a great career in government, and I didn't simply sit on my hands and regret that more couldn't be done. I rolled up my sleeves and tried to be part of the solution, not just the problem.
So what are some of the ways for people who aren't going to be able to get in the room and hear what everyone has to say to join in the conversation or follow along with what's going on?
Well, the presidential addresses will be live streamed, so they'll be accessible by television on various channels. And here on campus, we are going to hold student-led town hall meetings after each of the presidential addresses so that students, with a few faculty, but really with students in the lead, can say what all this means to the millennial generation, to their generation, and comment on what the four presidents said or failed to say about the agenda issues they care about most. And, you know, I should say a lot of these issues are controversial, and people come down at these issues in different ways, left, right, and center, and we want to stimulate a constructive, intelligent discussion about these issues, not to simply push any one particular agenda.
Can you give me an example of one of the issues that you find controversial that you hope gets discussed during the summit?
Well, the very first panel is on gay marriage as a civil right, and this is an open question. It is playing out in different ways across the country. The way the issue breaks in this state is different from the way it breaks in Massachusetts or Oregon, for example. And we ought to have a conversation about how the country should think about the issues of gay couples and gay rights in general. Immigration policy is another. That's the second panel, which will have Julian Castro, among others, on the panel. And again, there are legitimate differences of view about this issue. So what we want to do is explore possible solutions to this, not to simply figure that we have all the answers in advance.
If people are interested in finding more information out about the summit, where can they go?
There is a website, and I should have the web list before me. I don't have it handy, but civilrights.org, I think, or civilrightssummit.org, I think, is the way to find it, on the LBJ Presidential Library website and on the LBJ School website. You can find links to find out more information about the agenda, which is still evolving, and all the activities that will be going on.
Great. Well, Dean Hutchings, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.